Hi. So today on the Loopcast, I have Leslie Ann Warner, and we're discussing a report she's written, Trans-Sahara Counterterrorism Partnership, Building Partner Capacity to Counterterrorism and Violent Extremism. So I think this paper is kind of one of a kind. When we get into it, you'll, as the audience, you'll sort of hear why. And I think you can download a copy. We'll have a link available when the episode is posted, so you'll be able to read it and see sort of why this is sort of a unique report and why you know, anybody who's interested in African policy, U.S. policy towards Africa, should probably give it a look through. I want to start off with sort of walking us through this background of the Trans-Sahara Counterterrorism Partnership and, you know, how it came to be and who are some of the actors involved in sort of, you know, creating this partnership.
Sure. First of all, thank you so much for having me again on the Loopcast. I'm always happy to come and talk to you guys about what I'm doing. But to answer your question, so the Trans-Sahara Counterterrorism Partnership was an outgrowth of a previous program called the Pan-Sahel Initiative, PSI. PSI was a post-9/11 initiative that was primarily to train and equip company-sized, that's 150 guys, approximately 150 soldiers, company-sized rapid reaction counterterrorism forces in Mali, Niger, Chad, and Mauritania. And so across these six countries, the U.S. was building the capacity of about three companies in Mali and then one each across the other PSI countries. After a few years, the interagency got together again and said, well, with minimal investment, we can have a larger impact. Why don't we try and expand this program so it's not just a CT train and equip program? And why don't we also expand the countries that we're dealing with? And that's when the program expanded past the core four and expanded to include Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, Nigeria, Senegal, and eventually Burkina Faso. And I may be forgetting a country, forgive me. I always forget how many, but generally there's 10 countries in the program. And once it was expanded from PSI to TSCDP in 2005, that's when it wasn't just train and equip. It started to have a counter-violent extremism element to it as well. And so if you look at the structure of the program, it's a State Department-led interagency program. And so it's the three Ds are big players, state, DOD, USAID, and to some extent, Department of Justice is also a player. And they execute activities like military and law enforcement and justice sector counterterrorism capacity building, community engagement, public diplomacy and information operations, and vocational training. And so you can see the TSCDP has a much wider, a much broader focus than PSI, but it still has this very narrow counterterrorism and counterviolent extremism focus.
Interesting. So I want to sort of go through the interagency process. You've already mentioned that states involve USAID, DOD. You know, is it... You know, how are these relationships in your research? You know, how did you find that these relationships are balanced and sort of acted upon? I mean, is it really that's, you know, state sets the strategy and sort of everything flows from that? Or is there sort of give and take and sort of, you know, a flow to it? You know, is it smooth or is it, you know, very argumentative and very sort of inefficient? I mean, you know, sort of give us details to how this interagency process is working or has worked.
That's a great question, and it really just depends on the topic, the forum, the situation. I wouldn't say that there are that many animosities within the program. If you think about the structure of TSCTP, it's essentially a consortium of interagency stakeholders that have come together and said, look, there's a problem in this region. It's a region that is a backwater of U.S. strategic interest, relatively speaking. And it's a region where, especially in the core four countries of Mali, Niger, Chad, and Mauritania, but for some of the other countries as well, this program, as limited in scope as it is the biggest thing that goes on in these countries, or it's one of the biggest areas of U.S. engagement in these countries. And so you have all of these stakeholders coming together voluntarily to try and have a interagency regional approach to this problem, which means that they try and make decisions collaboratively. But the problem is that they, since they're equal partners, they didn't have a good way of adjudicating disputes within the program. And one of the instances in which this came to a head was a few years ago when they tried to rewrite the program strategy. The program had an original 2005 strategy, and the U.S. government stakeholders, state DOD, USAID, etc., they had tried to rewrite the strategy in 2010, but they couldn't agree on whether they were trying to defeat or deter Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM. And they didn't want to exert the political capital to have that dispute adjudicated at that particular time. And so the strategy was just never rewritten due to this issue. The irony of it after the fact, as I was able to capture in my interviews, is that this debate was actually outside the scope of TSCTP. TSCTP, and this is very important to note, is a capacity building program. It is a buy with and through program. Deter would have implied a more indirect approach, whereas defeat would have implied a more direct approach. And the reason for this wording dispute was because it had programmatic implications for the interagency. So it dictated what they were actually planning, what end state, or what the means by which they were trying to get to their end state. But the irony is that they were disagreeing over something that was outside the scope of the program. And I still can't figure out why that was. But that's just an interesting instance of how interagency, one instance of interagency tiffs. Another thing I've noticed is that some of the we haven't talked about how the structure of the program is on the country teams. And so the program is largely planned, bureaucracies here in D.C., state, USAID, DOJ, DOD, SOCOM down in Tampa, AFRICOM out in Stuttgart, out in Germany, and then in 10 country teams throughout the region. And those country teams have representatives from many of these agencies and bureaucracies. And so it has no dedicated DOD presence or dedicated anyone presence for TSCTP. But for DOD, this program is executed through the Defense Attaché, the Office of Security Cooperation, and in some cases, Special Forces Liaison Elements, SOFLIs, or Civil Military Support Elements, CIMSEs, or Military Information Support Teams, MISS. So the reason I call your attention to this is because these people are not part of the country team. They're not, some of them are not necessarily accustomed to the culture of the country team. And and because of the short amount of time they spend in country and because of their limited experience dealing with the U.S. Embassy country team, that's when some sort of interagency culture shocks can occur when both these TDY DOD personnel and the country team figure out how to work together. And then after a few months, the DOD people, these are the SOFLI, CIMSE, and MIST, not the DAT and the OSCE, when those people have to change out and then another crew of SOFLI, CIMSE, and MIST come in.
Okay. Wow. that was really complex. And
sorry.
No, it's okay. I'm sort of curious. I mean, if we could sort of walk back and maybe start at the top, what is the strategy that this program is going after? And, you mentioned that the strategy was there was arguments in 2005 and again in 2010. Walk us through the strategy, the strategy of, if I understood it correctly, of the word defeat versus deter. I mean, is there still arguments going on about what this partnership does and what its sort of purpose is?
So that's an excellent question. And so the outcome of this, when you look at this on paper and you see that there's these two silly little D words that the interagency couldn't agree on, it makes this disagreement kind of ridiculous. But again, when you think of it from a programmatic standpoint, that it actually has implications for how people plan for the activities that they're doing within the bounds of this program, it's actually quite an important dispute. And the way that it was dealt with was, first of all, it wasn't dealt with in 2010, and up until the Arab Awakening in 2011 and the crises in Mali, I refer to the influx of Tuareg returnees from heavily armed Tuareg returnees from Libya to Mali in late 2011, and the start of the Tuareg rebellion in late 2011, early 2012, and the subsequent coup in March 2012. Until the time that those happened, there was still no rewrite of the TSCTV strategy. Interagency stakeholders were still working off the 2005 strategy because the 2010 one hadn't been rewritten. And I think one of the reasons that the strategy is so important is that there's this wonderful GAO report. I hear your dog. That's okay. I just
He's
awkward, Luca.
battling the blanket right now. I don't know why. I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. We digress. So, where was I? So, the reason this is important is that actually, one of the few sources of information that's out there right now on TSCTP is the 2008 Government Accountability Office GAO report on how to improve implementation of the program. And so, the GAO had gone in and taken a look at the program, gone to visit some of the country teams, and they had concluded that, and this is not technical language, of course, but they had concluded that the strategy was so written so widely that you could drive a truck through it. Of course, they said it more eloquently and more analytically. And so that's what, I believe that's what created the impetus for the 2010 rewrite. And also, according to GAO, strategic planning guidelines say you have to revise your strategy every 3 to 5 years. And so, because no strategy was agreed to in 2011 or 2010, it just kind of fell off the radar. Again, this is a region that doesn't have a lot of, at least at the time, did not have a lot of high-level U.S. government attention. The people in the program are dealing with other issues, other implementation challenges, and so battling over these two words wasn't really a big deal in the bigger context of what was going on the continent and in the world in general. And so that's the backdrop to, as the Arab Awakening was going on, as the crises in Mali were unfolding, there was still no rewrite of the strategy. And I think that last year there was a high-level State Department and USAID initiative Sahel Maghreb strategy review, and then part of that was a TSCTP strategy review. And there's a draft strategy. I'm not sure if it's been signed yet, but there's a draft strategy that tries to address some of the issues that had come up in the 2010 strategy. And one of the ways they dealt with the D problem, the deter defeat problem, is now the language says that they're trying to contain, disrupt, degrade, and ultimately defeat the threat posed by Al-Qaeda, its affiliates, and associated violent extremist organizations. And so the language is, there's a lot of, there's clearly a thesaurus was used in trying to find words to describe all the things we were trying to do. But one of the things I was told is, look, using so many words to describe what we're doing leaves opportunities for a short, medium, and long-term approach, and that's really the way they've tried to address this deter defeat issue. In addition to the fact that there's higher level attention on it, and there's more of an imperative now that seeing that the region was in a bit of a crisis over the past few years, there's more of an imperative to get everyone on the same page.
So I'm sort of curious about two things. One is, it seems like every time you have an interagency process, you also bring in a whole body of law. So what is sort of the legal mechanism, guiding this process? I mean, it seems like you potentially have the State Department, which, is one set of laws, You have the military, which is another set of laws, and then, you know, intelligence agencies and whatever. You know, how does, you know, how is the problem of the law and the pro not a problem of the law, but sort of the legal requirements, you know, balanced or not, you know, not balanced? I mean, how does the how is the partnership approaching the issue of the law?
That I'm not entirely sure on. I'm not sure I can answer your question. Could
Okay.
you be more specific?
For instance, you know, if you have, if you're going to build up capacity in a place like Mali or a place like Mauritania, when you run into sort of issues of the Leahy Amendment or the issues of where, I think it is it the Leahy Amendment where you have the human rights being thwarted?
Yeah.
I mean, what happens when sort of the mission of capacity building runs into the issue of the law? Or what happens when legally, you know, the State Department is limited in what it can do, but the military is not? Or the military is limited in what it can and cannot do, but the State Department is not? Well, you know, how are the sort of legal issues and sort of legal requirements of each agency, you know, dealt with within this partnership? I mean, is it something that's discussed, or is it something that they sort of shrug their shoulders and say, you know, we'll deal with it as, you know, the problem goes on?
I think those sorts of issues were outside the purview of my study, but you did
No.
raise some points that I can comment on. So you'd mentioned the Leahy Amendment and also issues where assistance has been cut off for some sort of legal reason. One of the implementation challenges I raised in the study was that there are just certain cost of business, quote unquote, cost of business challenges. That you're going to encounter by engaging with the region. And one of those is that you're going to have to do Leahy vetting for, you're going to have to ensure that the security forces that you're working with have not committed human rights violations. And some of these countries don't have particularly good record keeping, or they might spell certain names differently. And so it can be very difficult for the embassies to track down information on who exactly is attending these training sessions in a timely fashion, and as a result, that person can't attend the training, or the country team doesn't have enough people to attend this particular training session, and so that reduces the impact of our engagement. Another issue is that there are quite a few reasons why our assistance may be restricted or cut off. So some of the countries had, for example, Chad at some point had a child soldier issue. I was told that this was not because of malicious intent, but because, again, because of bad record keeping. People who might look like they're of age might not be of age, and there might not be very good records to verify. I've been told that in that case in particular, Chad has been very proactive about working with the U.S. to try and get child soldiers out of their military. But at the end of the day, if there are issues like presence of child soldiers, budgetary transparency issues, those are issues that require a presidential waiver to have non-humanitarian assistance granted to these countries. And to clarify, if there's no presidential waiver and the country doesn't have adequate budgetary transparency or has presence of child soldiers or little stipulations like that, they need a waiver signed by the president for the U.S. to be able to offer them certain assistance. And then there was another issue of when assistance gets cut off, and I actually learned quite a bit after the coup in Mali when so everyone knows once a coup happens, non-humanitarian assistance gets cut off. That's per Section 7008 of the Foreign Assistance Act. I did not know, and that's usually Title 10 State Department assistance. I did not know until the coup in Mali that Title 10 DoD assistance, that's your Section 1206, Section 1208, which is some of the funding that the authorities that are used to train and equip partner nation rapid reaction counterterrorism forces, that assistance is not necessarily subject to the same restrictions. However, for policy reasons, so there's a policy decision that's made within the U.S. government to cut off that sort of assistance as well. And that's actually what's happened in Mali. And actually, interesting fact, as of a few weeks ago, the Title X assistance has not been reinstated to Mali, that sort of security assistance.
Interesting.
Even though they've returned to democracy.
So I want to, before we get into sort of the issue of, you know, how this partnership is engaging in its in the target countries, I'm sort of interested, you know, where is the funding coming from for this partnership? I mean, are we talking about that each participating agency has its own funding flows, and then from those from that basic, you know, funding, they contribute, you know, staff to the interagency process? Or is the partnership itself, you know, its own thing, so it's being funded? And, you know, maybe a sub question to this, I mean, does the partnership have funding issues? I mean, is it sort of this robustly funded partnership, you know, maybe despite, you know, the lack of attention in DC, but it, still it has a, you know, enough money and enough, you know, staff to sort of achieve its ends? Or is there, you know, neither the staff nor the money?
Okay, so let me, I'll address the funding issue first. So TSCP receives between 90 million and 90 million with an M and $160 million per year. And that is actually not that much money considering it's spread across 10 countries, not entirely evenly, of course. But in terms of understanding the structural weaknesses of these countries and all that needs to be done to bolster stability in these countries, $90 to $160 million really isn't all that much. And also considering the fact that they're spread over all of those functional categories that I mentioned, the military, law enforcement, justice sector capacity building, vocational training, community engagement, and public diplomacy and information operations. So the reason that range is so wide, $90 to $160 million, is that only $50 to $55 million per year are line item TSCTP funds from the State Department. The rest are from globally competitive accounts. And so from year to year, you can't necessarily predict how much the program is necessarily going to get. So that's the reason for the range. And the types of money that go into TSCDP are sources such as the Economic Support Fund, Development Assistance, International Narcotics and Law Enforcement, the Anti-Terrorism Assistance, Section 1206 Global Train and Equip, Section 1208 Support to Foreign Forces, that's the Special Forces Training, the Combat Terrorism Fellowship. So there's a whole bunch of different colors of money that go into TSCTP.
Right. Interesting. So I want to sort of...
Through the staffing...
Oh, I'm sorry. You keep cutting out. I'm sorry. Hold
on. So...
Okay, we're back. Technical difficulties. So start us up again, Leslie.
Okay, so I just left off at talking about the various funding streams that go into TSCTP, but I also was going to talk about the fact that despite this, all of these funding streams, there's no operational support fund for TSCTP, so there's nothing to fund, for example, a program officer or support staff to really help improve coordination of the program and improve oversight of the program on a day-to-day basis.
Interesting. So I want to maybe get into the day-to-day basis. Especially in your paper, you do highlight sort of the functional engagements of this partnership. And if you could sort of walk us through what each sort of engagement entails. In the paper, you list military capacity building, law enforcement and anti-terror capacity building, the justice sector, public diplomacy, information operations, community engagement, and sort of vocational training. So walk us through what this, you know, what those seven categories practically mean on the ground. Sort of, you know.
Okay.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay, I'll give you a general flavor for what sorts of engagement activities go under those categories. So military capacity building is just like the original Pan-Sahel initiative. It's training small rapid reaction counterterrorism forces to find, fix, and finish violent extremist organizations and increasing regional security cooperation. So this is by no means a security sector reform program. It's by no means engagement with entire militaries. It's engagement with small groups of rapid reaction forces. Just give you a sense of the scale of this program. And another example is of a TSCTP activity under this functional category is Exercise Flintlock, which occurred last month and part of this month in Niger, which is a regional counterterrorism interoperability exercise. Under law enforcement and anti-terrorism capacity building, that is training and equipping partner nation law enforcement entities to secure borders against trafficking of drugs, people, and other contraband. And so that is usually, the regional security officer on the embassy country team will coordinate either classroom or field-based training sessions to focus on terrorist interdiction or interdiction of traffickers or border security. And the partner nation entities that are usually engaged are partner nation gendarmerie, in some events, police forces. So under justice sector counterterrorism capacity building, that's really, that has several parts to it. So that is, there's a resident legal advisor in some of the country teams. That's a, I think they're DOJ employee on the country teams that's responsible for building partner nation counterterrorism legislative capacity, harmonizing regional counterterrorism legislation, helping them with their counter transnational organized crime legislation, which includes anti-money laundering and counterterrorism financing capacity, USAID and INL, I think this is particularly in Morocco, they work on a counter-prison radicalization program where they work with people who manage the prisons. They work with people in the corrections sector to try and improve the quality of these prisons to decrease recidivism and decrease radicalization while people are in jail, in prison. Under public diplomacy and information operations, the general purpose behind that is that's the really heavy counter violent extremism push within the program, and that's reducing the spread of violent extremist ideology and encouraging moderation and tolerance in these partner nations and working with key local opinion shapers and also encouraging populations to cooperate with law enforcement and the military. That last element is usually what the MIST teams do, what the military information support teams do. They'll produce billboards or handouts to advertise the local equivalent of 911 to try and get countries, people in these countries to report untoward activities to their law enforcement. A subsidiary question to that is, do partner nation populations actually trust their law enforcement military? But that is a question for another day. Under community engagement, that's kind of a catch-all category. That is key leader, youth, and civil society engagement that can focus on mitigating conflict, also countering violent extremism. The CIMSEs, the civil military support elements, also do MEDCAPs and VETCAPs. Those are medical and veterinary civil affairs clinics that are used to demonstrate service delivery or demonstrate that someone is reaching out to marginalized populations that might be vulnerable to violent extremism. And then finally, vocational training is part of the program, and that includes increasing opportunities for social and economic inclusion of at-risk youth in order to mitigate the chance that they would be recruited into terrorist groups. And one of the big programs that USAID has with across TSCTP countries in Burkina Faso, Chad, and Niger is called Peace Through Development 2, PDEV2. PDEV2 kind of, it has a big vocational training element to it, but it also has elements of community engagement and public diplomacy. But under PDEV2 and across other country teams, USAID is usually involved in working with building, doing vocational training, focusing on, for example, carpentry or auto mechanic repair or things like that, to give people the skills to be gainfully employed and also try and mitigate any tendencies towards violent extremism. The argument is if you give them an economic outlet, then, you know, that will lead to reduced violent extremism, reduced susceptibility or increased resilience. That's the phrase, resilience to violent extremism.
So has this functional engagement been successful? I mean, would you consider it, I mean, you know, without getting into, you know, the critique and sort of, you know, a larger critique, I mean, would you consider it through your research, has it been a success?
Well, that is a wonderful question that I get asked every time I brief this presentation. The challenge with answering that is, first of all, there don't seem to be adequate monitoring and evaluation mechanisms within the program. And in fact, one of the outcomes of the, or one of the findings from the interagency TSCTP review was that they needed to have stricter monitoring and evaluation of what the program was doing so that they could gauge whether or not they were being successful or how successful they were being. But another challenge associated with that is that in order to have better monitoring and evaluation, you need to have a more robust program staff. And how do you have a more robust program staff if you don't have the funding for that? So there's a lot of knock-on, you know, challenges trying to get a better sense of how successful the program is. And I would also call your attention to the original, I call it the original GAO report because the GAO is coming out with a TSCTP report in June as well. They'll have a slightly different focus. Actually, it'll probably have a very different focus from mine because they tend to focus at a different level of analysis. But the 2008 report, the original report, had one of the critiques was that there wasn't sufficient monitoring and evaluation and that program staff was measuring outputs rather than outcomes. So they were measuring how many trucks were delivered or how many people went through training as opposed to what the partner nation military did with those trucks or if they did anything at all or whether the people that we did vocational training for actually gained, were gainfully employed subsequently.
I want to sort of move on to dealing with sort of three potential pitfalls. The first one is, you know, if Africa is sort of this policy backwater, you know, why is it that, you know, it seems like the U.S. has a lot of policy interests in Africa, both in the Sahara and in the Horn of Africa and Great Lakes region, but yet is being defined in D.C. as a sort of backwater in terms of funding. I mean, is that, I mean, because I'm sort of having, as an analyst, as an outsider, sort of having a hard time syncing up that, you know, there seems to be a very complex strategy, but yet no real policy interest from DC. Is there, I mean, is this sort of true or is this sort of, I mean, help me puzzle through why this region is being considered a backwater. And, you know, it really does seem that the US does have a sort of, or should have a strong policy interest in North Africa.
Well, one of the things I always emphasize when I'm critiquing analyses of U.S.-Africa policy or when in my own writing itself, I always emphasize that it's important to understand U.S.-Africa policy in the context of broader strategic interests globally defined. And so if you think about where Africa ranks globally, you can argue that the U.S. has interests in Africa and that they may be growing, and I may agree with you, but at the same time, U.S. interests in Africa are not going to trump Iran's nuclear program or a nuclear North Korea or withdrawing from Afghanistan or, you know, I could keep a list going on about the things that are going to trump U.S. interest in Africa. If you think about the context of U.S. Africa policy itself, the Sahel is, you could argue that the U.S. interests in Africa tend to be focused on the Horn of Africa, the Sahel, and the Gulf of Guinea. During the heyday of al-Shabaab back between 2006 and arguably 2011, the Horn of Africa was really the major focus for the U.S. After the Arab awakening and the crises in Mali, especially given that a lot of the U.S.'s key partners in North Africa, or not key partners, but the bulwarks against instability, for better or for worse, are gone. You know, your Mubarak is gone, Ben Ali is gone, Gaddafi, even though we were coming to terms with him by the time he was deposed, but the fact that he could play some sort of mediating role or inflammatory role in the region, the fact that these controlling personalities or countries are gone means that the U.S. has had to have a more increased focus on this particular region. And so I would argue that in the context of U.S. Africa policy, the Sahel has become quite important. But in the global context of things, it's still very much a policy backwater.
Interesting. So I want to sort of move to two critiques that are, I'm going to specifically sort of shoot at the, not your paper, but sort of the idea of this counterterrorism partnership. And one of them, I think, we've already touched on, but, you know, how do you establish goals and metrics to this program or to this partnership? Because it seems like you do have a strategy, you know, maybe you can sort of ignore the deter versus defeat debate, but, you know, how do you establish goals and metrics? You know, I think you've already mentioned that there is an argument of sort of comparing outputs versus outcomes, the delivery of 50 trucks versus, you know, how the recipient used those trucks. So, you know, within the program and sort of, you know, outside the program and within your sort of your analysis, you know, how are metrics and sort of outcomes and goals sort of established and measured?
That I don't know particularly, because that was once I realized that they had identified a problem with the metrics and they hadn't quite figured out at the time how they were going to address it. I didn't really focus all that much on the metrics and more on the other implementation challenges. But one thing I will say about that is one discussion that I had early on with some of the TSCTP U.S. government stakeholders was a discussion of what is good enough for the region. And so if you think about the countries that you're dealing with, you're not dealing with the most stable places on Earth. You're dealing with places that are some of the poorest on Earth. They don't have very strong political or economic institutions. Their security forces may not be very professional. You're dealing with places that have high levels of public corruption, high levels of unemployment or underemployment. And so when you're encountering all of these challenges and you have a program that is so limited to counterterrorism and counterviolent extremism, and you have limited program staff and limited funding, you then have to raise the question of, okay, well, what's good enough? What can we actually accomplish in this region, given all of these challenges that we're encountered with in the region and on our own side in terms of planning and implementing this program? Interesting. And the answer to that is, I don't know what's good enough. That is still being debated.
I mean, isn't that an issue though? I mean, if you can't define what's good enough, then how do you establish if you're growing or shrinking or progressing or, you know, I mean,
I completely agree with you. And how do you figure out, well, one thing I keep saying is the purpose of a capacity building program should be to put yourself out of business. If you don't know how close you're getting to putting yourself out of business, then how are you supposed to get to that point where you've built the partner nation capacity so much that you don't need to be doing capacity building anymore, or you need to be doing a more advanced level of capacity building? That's been very difficult to articulate.
So, I mean, in your research, is that a problem of simply that the problem itself is so huge that you can't really define it? Or is that the problem of sort of the policy and the strategy, that the problem solver or the team is not able to sort of, you know, articulate the issue well enough to figure it out and to solve it? Or is that simply like the problem is so intractable that, you know, you just sort of shrug your shoulders and, as you said, sort of, you know, what's good enough, or, you know, what can you do with limited resources and limited staff?
Part of the problem is, or part of the challenge is trying to determine what you can do with limited resources, or what is the most reasonable outcome you can have with limited resources. And I should also mention that the program likes to take credit for some of the recent successes of the program. So, for example, if you remember how the Chadian Special Anti-Terrorism Group, the SATGI, they went all the way across Chad, Niger, and into northern Mali, and they were the only African force that participated in offensive operations alongside the French to clear northern Mali of terrorist groups. That was last spring. And so that was touted as a huge success because that was one of the security forces that was trained under TSCTP. There's also examples of Mauritania has had very tangible success, I've been told, in terms of demonstrating its ability to find, fix, and finish VEOs, to use effectively the security assistance that we've been giving them over the past few years. I'm sorry, I've gotten a bit off track. You were saying something about...
It just seems like there might be a tendency for mission creep, and the idea that you start with a loose enough strategy and a wide enough strategy that you can drive a truck through, and suddenly you lose sight of what the original mission was. That, you know, especially it almost seems like the way that you described the problem is that it almost seems so intractable that engagement with it is really, you're limited down to what's good enough. But I don't know. I think I just lost my place in the notes. I want to sort of end the show with, I think, a critique that I think is probably the sharpest critique, and I think it's been leveled many times, you know, not just at AFRICOM, but sort of U.S. sort of strategy writ large, and that is, you know, is the counterterrorism approach to Africa and to sort of, you know, not just the Sahara, but also the Horn of Africa, this idea that you're going to engage the continent through a very specific lens of counterterrorism and countering violent extremism. I mean, is this the right approach? I mean, is this the sort of right policy approach?
That's an excellent question, and that gets to one of the more important issues that's infused throughout the report. So given the structural issues that you and I attempted to discuss in the last question, in which we both lost our trains of thought, given these large structural issues that the region faces and our very limited counterterrorism, counter-violent extremism approach, one would argue that clearly more needs to be done in this region in order to address some of the major drivers of instability. And when I first started off this project, I should have mentioned earlier on in this interview that for this project, I interviewed pretty much everyone in the U.S. government, or most of the people in the U.S. government who are involved in this program. And then I went to the 9 of the 10 TSCTP country teams to also interview most of the people who were involved in implementing the program. And one of the questions I asked early on was this even the right focus for the program? Should we even have been doing counterterrorism? And everyone said, well, clearly we should be doing counterterrorism because that's what's in our vital interests, or our strategic interests in that particular part of the world. Was it the only thing that needed to be done? Of course not. So they faced this catch, well, the program faces this catch-22, where more needs to be done, but there's not a high enough level of strategic interest to be able to drive additional funding and resources to focus on this sort of issue set. And if you think about it, this is not just one program you're dealing with. You're not just trying to do this 150 million or whatever the funding for that particular year is. You're not just doing that program in a country like Niger or Chad. you're doing this in 10 countries, which means that if you were to have a more robust approach, you would need to do that in most of the other countries, because otherwise you're going to have a balloon effect where the threats and vulnerabilities just travel from one weak state to the other to the other. And I came to this conclusion as I was starting to draft the report. I then saw the TSCTB strategy review. I went and I briefed my findings to the people I'd interviewed earlier on in the study to make sure that my findings were grounded in reality. And one of my recommendations, which ended up being one of their findings from their own internal review, was that because this program is so narrowly focused and doesn't address key drivers of instability that ultimately lead to these counterterrorism programs not being as successful as they could have been, it's important to link these CT programs to broader non-CT U.S. engagement. And on a secondary point, it's important to link these non-CT or these CT U.S. programs to what other countries, what partner nations, what bilateral entities like the French and the UK, and what multilateral entities like the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, the European Union, and the UN are also doing in the region, so that you increase the legitimacy of your engagement and you also are able to leverage complementary efforts. So the bottom line is, if you're not going to focus on things like building democratic institutions and building rule of law that doesn't exclusively focus on counterterrorism, then it gives you an imperative to try and work with other people who are, because it at the end of the day, it makes your counterterrorism program more effective.
Interesting. So I think we've sort of reached the end of the episode, and I want to sort of, before we go, you know, we always like to have the guests give us a last word. So I mean, before we sign off for the night, give us a last word and sort of something to think about. I mean, you've already given us a lot to think about, but even more.
Even more. You were asking too much. I'm just kidding. So first of all, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our discussion. Please, I hope that the report comes out soon enough. I'm hoping that it'll be posted by Monday when this goes up on the internet. Please read the report. It's extremely unique. I'm very proud of it. It's unique because that kind of information has not been compiled for public release, explaining what exactly the program does and doesn't do. And even though it may sound, you know, I may speak kind of jokingly about the program, but it is a rather innovative way of executing U.S. foreign policy. U.S. foreign policy is executed bilaterally, and this is an instance in which interagency partners have come together and said, look, we're not really doing much in this region. Let's pool our resources. Let's put our heads together. Let's try and figure out an approach to the threats and vulnerabilities in this region, which is actually quite rare within U.S. foreign policy that there would be a regional approach to this sort of security problem. The other example that people turn to is the gold standard for interagency engagement, which is the Joint Interagency Task Force South, JIATF South. TSCTP is no JIATF South, but, you know, it definitely provides a platform on which to learn and improve the program moving forward.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
No problem.